You're listening to CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager. In this episode, Phil takes a moment to go over a few of the more common questions that some students have sent in reference to studying for the CPA exam.
Hello, everyone. Today, this is a different type of podcast. We've been actually doing CPA Review, but more. Today, what I decided to do is, first of all, my guest is Phil Yeager. Hi, Phil. How are you? I'm really good. Thank you. All right. But anyway, what we're going to do today is we thought, hey, we're going to concentrate a little more on the CPA review aspect of this podcast. And I decided to actually go over some issues, questions that students have actually presented to me lately. All right. And these are areas that they have questions on, and they want a further explanation. So I figured, hey, you know what? I'll do a podcast and discuss these questions. Now, I got a call the other day from a student who wanted me to discuss with them, and this is in the stockholders' equity section of financial accounting. It had to do with what is a quasi-reorganization and what are the steps you must do, all right, to go through the quasi-reorganization. Well, if you remember, and I believe there is a blueprint on this, excuse me, all right? When it comes to a quasi-reorganization, the purpose is to eliminate a deficit in retained earnings. Now, why do you want to eliminate that deficit? Well, as long as you have a deficit, you cannot pay out dividends. So if you can't pay out dividends, then who's going to want to buy your stock? So when a company goes through this quasi-reorganization, they're going to eliminate the deficit in retained earnings. Also, when a company is going through a quasi-reorganization, generally their assets are overvalued. So one of the other things we have to do in the quasi-reorganization is to reduce the value of the assets to bring them to the current fair value. They're overvalued. And then, all right, we have to eliminate the deficit in retained earnings. Now let's talk about the entries generally that occur in a quasi-reorganization. You'll generally see that they'll tell you that the paid in capital that you have in your equity section, that paid in capital, all right, will reduce the deficit in retained earnings. However, there's generally not enough additional paid in capital to cover that deficit. So the company will have to go through a few things to get some more additional paid in capital. So the first thing they'll do is they'll generally say the company reduced their par value of the common stock from X to Y. So the entry you're going to make when they do that is to debit common stock for the reduction. And then that decrease in equity, which will go to paid in capital, which means you'll credit paid in capital for that decrease. So let me repeat that. All right. You'll debit common stock and you will credit additional paid in capital. Now that starts building up the additional paid in capital to eliminate the deficit in retained earnings. Now, once again, I told you in a quasi-reorganization, generally the assets are overvalued. Well, if they're overvalued, we have to reduce them to bring them to their fair market value. So what entry do we make on the books for this? Well, we're going to credit the asset, all right? And by writing down the asset to fair value, it further increases the deficit in retained earnings. So we're going to debit retained earnings. So let's go over these two entries. One, all right, there's not enough paid in capital to get rid of the deficit in retained earnings. So we got to come up with additional paid in capital. And the way we do that is by reducing the par value of the common stock by debiting it and crediting additional paid in capital. Also, all right, remember, the assets are generally overvalued in a situation where the company has a deficit in retained earnings. So what they're going to do is this, all right, they're going to write down the assets to fair value by crediting the assets, and they'll debit retained earnings. So now the retained earnings has the original deficit plus the additional deficit created because you wrote down the assets. Now, what do? All right, you should have enough paid in capital to eliminate the deficit. So what you do is, all right, you're going to credit retained earnings, all right, to bring the deficit down to zero, and then you're going to debit additional paid in capital. All right. Now, what they generally ask you is this. What is the additional paid in capital after the quasi-reorganization? And also, all right, what's the balance in retained earnings? Well, the balance in the retained earnings will be what? Zero. Now, remember, one of the disclosures you must do going through a quasi-reorganization is in your financial statements, in a footnote, you must disclose that over the last, all right, you got to mention this for a 10-year period. So for the next 10 years, you have to say, hey, then went through a quasi-reorganization and they had an original deficit of so much. So you want to show that the company really is not starting off with a zero retained earnings. All right. You want to mention that they went through a quasi-reorganization where the deficit was so much, and now they're eliminating the deficit to bring it to zero. So now, hopefully, the company will become profitable, they'll build up retained earnings, and they'll be paying out dividends to their shareholders. So that is what we have with a quasi-reorganization, all right? And it is one of the blueprints. Now, another area, all right, that came up was dealing with earnings per share, all right? The person had trouble remembering, when do you do basic earnings per share, and when do you calculate diluted? Well, first of all, basic is exactly that. Basic in the denominator, all right, just includes the weighted average number of outstanding shares, all right? It doesn't add to that, all right, any common stock equivalents, all right? Which means, for example, all right, if you have convertible preferred stock, convertible bonds, all right, the assumption is for earnings per share that even if those were not actually converted, you did convert them, all right, to get dilution, lower earnings per share. Now, remember, you really have not necessarily converted the bonds or preferred stock to common stock, but you assume you do that, all right, which means that if you assume that the conversion of there's convertible preferred stock or convertible bonds, remember, it is done on the first day, January 1st. So whatever you convert them to, all right, to common stock, that common stock is already weighted for 12 months because all conversions are assumed to occur on what date? If it's fully diluted, it is January 1st. But let's stay with the basic earnings per share. All right. This is what you do. You take your net income. You want to come up with net income available to common stockholders. And what you're going to subtract is this. If they paid any dividends to preferred stockholders, or if they have cumulative preferred stock, but they did not pay out dividends to them, all right, you always subtract 1 year of dividends. So if they pay more than 1 year of dividends in arrears, you're only going to subtract from that net income 1 year of dividends to the preferred stockholders. Now, in basic earnings per share, that will give you the net income available to the common stockholders. Now, you're going to divide that by the weighted average number of outstanding shares, the actual shares you have. Now, if for some reason they had a stock dividend or a stock split, all right, do the weighting of the shares, and then, all right, just multiply each layer that you weight times, if it's a 3-for-1 stock split, you multiply it by 3, and that's the weighted average with the stock split. If it's a stock dividend of 10%, take the weighted average shares you have and multiply it by 10%, which would be 1.10, all right? Now, notice, all right, we assume when there's a stock split or stock dividend, it occurred on January 1st. So once again, all right, the stock dividend, the stock split assumes that the shares are weighted from January 1st. All right. Now, there's no common stock equivalents in basic earnings per share. Now, let's talk about the computation with fully diluted earnings per share. Well, in fully diluted earnings per share, all right, the formula is the following. It is, let me go over this with you. It is, you take the net income, all right, now, if you have convertible bonds, you assume that the bonds were convertible on January 1st, and if there's any interest expense on your income statement, you're going to have to add back the interest expense net of taxes. So you take net income, you add back interest expense net of taxes, all right, because remember, the conversion of the bonds occurred January 1st, so you didn't have any bonds. So if you paid any interest, You got to add it back to net income, net of tax. Please remember that. And also, all right, you're now dividing by the weighted average number of shares plus the shares from converting to preferred stock, the common, all right, or convertible bonds to stock. And remember, because the conversion occurred January 1st, all right, those shares are already weighted for 12 months. Now, when we deal with diluted earnings per share, all right, I think you need to know this, all right? What you're going to do is, all right, you're going to actually take into account two possible methods, all right? Well, the one is called the as-if converted, and that deals with the bonds. And the as-if says you have to add back the interest and net income, net of taxes. Also, we have the treasury stock method with fully diluted earnings per share. The treasury stock method says this. You have stock options that you're actually exercising to common stock. Now, what you're going to do is this, all right? You're going to issue the additional stock, but with the proceeds from the options, you'll divide those proceeds by the average market price of the stock, all right? And that will give you the number of shares of the stock that you issued with stock options, all right, that you're buying back as treasury stock. So you'll take the number of shares having to do with stock options, and then the shares you're buying back will reduce that, and that will be your net number of shares that you'll use in the computation of fully diluted or diluted, all right? I use the term fully diluted. That's the old thing, okay? So once again, all right, here's the formula for diluted earnings per share, all right? You take the net income. Now, you do subtract any current year preferred dividends, just like you do in basic earnings per share. But now, all right, being if you have convertible bonds, because you have a common stock equivalent in diluted earnings per share, all right, you're going to add back the interest net of taxes. And then your denominator will be the weighted average number of common shares outstanding plus any potentially diluted common shares. And that's the what? The convertible preferred stock, the convertible bonds, which actually assume converted on January 1st. So therefore, it's for a full year. All right. Now, let me tell you a few hints here. As I mentioned, convertible bonds are always assumed to be converted at the beginning of the year. All right. Also, convertible preferred stock is assumed to be converted at the beginning of the year. And the treasury stock method we mentioned is used for stock options and stock warrants. All right. And the treasury stock method assumes what? That the options and warrants are exercised at the beginning of the year or at the date of issue. All right. If they're actually issued during the year. And the proceeds from the options or warrants, all right, you're going to divide that by the average market price. And that's the number of shares you're going to buy back of the shares that were issued through the options or warrants. Okay. Now, this is what you want to do. All right. And by the way, let me read to you the blueprint on this earnings per share. Calculate basic earnings per share. All right. Another blueprint. Calculate diluted earnings per share. So they're going to ask you that. Now, the hardest thing with that is, first of all right, when you're dealing with this denominator, weighted average number of shares, all right, make sure you know how to do weighted average, all right, with the actual outstanding shares, all right? Practice that computation. Now, I showed that computation of weighted average shares. I did a YouTube video on the Yeager CPA Review YouTube. It's there. Watch it, all right? I show you an easy method to do weighted average number of shares. And also, all right, what you should do is do some multiple choice on that, all right? That's the best way to practice, multiple choice. All right, now, that's a question that came up. Now, another question that came up, all right, on financial accounting, all right, and it was one of the blueprints. How do you measure impairment losses on inventory? Now, there are three methods of valuing inventory, and they are, all right, they are, depending upon the type of inventory, there is LIFO, FIFO, and average cost. Now, let's go to FIFO and average cost. If you use FIFO or average cost, you value the inventory at the lower of cost or net realizable value. But LIFO still values inventory at the lower of cost or market. Now let's go to the FIFO method and the average cost method. Lower of cost or net realizable value. Well, what is net realizable value? Net realizable value is defined as the selling price, all right, minus the cost to make the goods available for distribution. That's the net realizable value. So you value it at the lower of the cost or that net realizable value. And that's for FIFO and average cost. Now, with LIFO, it's the lower of cost to market. And now market, we have to look at certain ranges. Now, when you're doing lower of cost to market, put the cost aside, all right, and let's determine the market value. Now, we have to look at our ceiling and our floor. The maximum market value would be is the ceiling, and that is the net realizable value. The selling price minus the cost to make the goods available for distribution. The floor, which means the minimum amount the market can be in lower of cost to market, is the net realizable value minus the normal profit margin. Now, they're going to give you replacement cost. If the replacement cost falls within the floor and the ceiling, then your market price is called replacement cost compared to the actual cost. The lower the two is the way you value your inventory. But if they give you replacement cost and it's below the floor, all right, then you don't use replacement cost as market. What you do is this. Bring the replacement cost up to the floor. The floor is the net realizable value minus the normal profit margin. That will be your market price. So when the replacement costs are below the floor, bring it up to the floor, and now your market value is the what? The net realizable value minus the normal profit margin. Compare that to the actual cost, and you value the LIFO at the lower of cost or market. Now, if the replacement cost exceeds the ceiling, which is the net realizable value, all right, you bring the replacement cost down to the ceiling, and now your market price will be net realizable value. You'll compare that to the cost, and you value the inventory at the lower of cost or market. Now, once you determine your cost, all right, what happens? Well, you must test that inventory for impairment. Now, if you're using the periodic method, by the way, every one of those, FIFO, LIFO, has a periodic and perpetual method, and also average cost. But average cost, their periodic method is called the weighted average, and the perpetual method for average cost is called the moving average. So if you're using perpetual inventory methods, when you purchase the inventory, remember, you debit inventory, right? You owe money on it, credit accounts payable. But if you're using the periodic method, you don't debit inventory, you debit the purchase account and credit accounts payable. Now, with perpetual inventory, when you finally sell it, all right, what do you do under perpetual? You're going to credit the inventory and debit cost of goods sold. So now we have a cost of goods sold account. But under the periodic method, we don't take it out of the inventory and debit cost of goods sold because we don't keep track of what we sell under the periodic method. So what we do under the periodic method is we actually have a cost of goods sold section in the income statement under the periodic, which is made up of the beginning inventory plus your net purchases. And net purchases, purchases minus purchase returns and allowances minus purchase discounts. That's your net purchases. And also, you add to that any freight in, not freight out, right? Freight in. Freight out is a selling expense. Freight in is an inventory cost, and it's also called transportation in. So you take your beginning inventory plus your net purchases plus your freight in, and that gives you the total cost of your goods available for sale. Now, under the periodic method, the only way you can calculate your ending inventory, because you're not keeping track of what you're selling under the periodic, is by counting the inventory. All right. So you count your inventory, figure out what it costs, subtract it from the goods available for sale, which is the beginning inventory plus the net purchase plus the freight in. That's the goods available for sale. Subtract the ending inventory that you counted, and that will give you the cost of goods sold. If the market value or the net realizable value is lower than the cost of the inventory is stated to be impaired. Now, how do we handle that from a journal entry standpoint? Well, if you're using the periodic method, which does not record inventory account, all right, an entry must be made to the following. This is how you record the impairment. You debit loss on write-down of inventory, which is an expense. The credit to the entry is to the ending inventory asset account on the balance sheet. Now, under the perpetual method, all right, inventory is recorded, all right, by debiting inventory, all right, which is a cost of goods sold account. So to record the impairment, we debit loss on write-down of inventory, and we credit the inventory account directly, which is a cost of goods sold account, and it's not the asset as in the, what, periodic method, right? All right. We actually charge the asset directly, the inventory, all right? We're not charging the inventory that's on the balance sheet. And when an asset is impaired, such as inventory, all right, if you recover any of that cost, all right, which means the net realizable value or market value starts going up, you do not record recovered losses. Please remember that. You don't reverse it. And one other thing I want to tell you is this, all right? When it comes to inventory measurement methods, remember, IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, all right, does not permit a company to use LIFO. LIFO is not permitted under IFRS. So anyway, that will conclude what we're going to cover today in the half hour. And by the way, yes, I only went over financial. We'll cover the other areas. All right, we'll cover regulation. All right, and by the way, speaking of regulation, all right, know this point because this comes up. Is the medical itemized deduction for taxes, does it exceed 10% of AGI or 7.5% of AGI for 2018 tax returns? And the answer is, for 2018, which you're doing now, if you're preparing tax returns, all right, you take your total medical, all right, your unreimbursed medical, and you subtract for 2018, 7.5% of AGI. Just want to clarify that for you. So anyway, that is our podcast for today. I want to thank our guest, Phil Yeager. You're very welcome. And we will do another podcast on CPA review. And once again, any areas, any questions you may have, all right, please contact us and we will bring up those topics on the podcast when we cover the CPA review topics. Take care, everyone, and thank you very much.
Thanks again for listening to CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager. If you have any questions or topics you'd like to hear about, we want to hear from you. Send your feedback live to us here at the studio at podcast@YeagerCPAReview.com. That email will also be in the podcast description for this episode. If you're in the market for a review course or simply want to know more about Yeager CPA Review and what we have to offer, check out our website. Link will be in the description as well. Don't forget to use promo code PODCAST to take advantage of 15% off your purchase of the CPA Review course bundles on the Yeager website. And if you haven't already, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast to keep hearing more of the great podcasts that CPA Review and More has to offer. Until next time, take care.